This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast.
Hey, you're listening to the Bite Size Business Breakfast. Everything that Tom, Richard and myself have been up to. On a Thursday morning, May the 30th, that includes a special restaurant focus this morning. Having had a conversation a little bit earlier in the week about rising restaurant rents, we wanted to see what it actually takes to survive and thrive in the business here. We've been speaking to Corin Bowker. She's the CEO of the Lime Tree Cafe. She's kept it going for nearly a quarter of a century. We've also been speaking to one man who's made a business out of filling restaurants with beautiful people. There is an app for that. We've been speaking to the CEO and the founder of the Secret Society Dubai. And we've been looking at the UAE President Sheikh Mohammed's visit to China. From a trade point of view, we've been speaking to Patrick Zhang. He is the head of Zhang's Group, that is a family office with roots in Hong Kong and here in the UAE as well. Plus, has the Chinese investor come back to the Dubai property market yet? And are we ready for them if they do? John Lyons is the Managing Director of Espace Real Estate. You're listening to The Business Breakfast. Tom, Rich and Brandy with you this morning. And a couple of focuses on the show this morning.
That is the soundtrack to the visit of His Highness Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed Al Nahyan, who is the President of the United Arab Emirates. He's on a state visit to China today and tomorrow. So negotiations are happening as we speak. We've been getting some reaction to this. Patrick Zhang is a business leader who has, if you like, a foot in both camps. His family office is based in Hong Kong. They do a lot of business in China. But recently, during COVID, in fact, they also set up a significant operation here in the Middle East. So we asked Patrick, who joined us live from Hong Kong, why is Sheikh Mohammed's visit to China significant?
I think it's an amazing trip. I think the last time when Sheikh Mohammed went to China and saw President Xi was during the Winter Olympics 2022 in Beijing. I think there's a few significant events happening as we speak. This is the second decade of the Belt Road Initiative, which is the big project from President Xi. It's the Comprehensive Strategic Partnership Framework, which is being designed and signed. It's also, from the UAE's perspective, it's the 40th anniversary of diplomatic ties between China and the UAE. And then also China is obviously the UAE's biggest trading partner. Bilateral trade has reached around $95 billion in 23, and mainly energy, technology and media.
So it is significant trade. That's Patrick's view as a business person. He runs the Sangs family office, which bears his name. But what about the economist's view? Khatija Haque, chief economist, Emirates NBD.
China is the UAE's largest non-oil trade partner, with the value of non-oil trade reaching almost 300 billion dirhams last year and accounting for 12% of the UAE's total non-oil trade. The UAE has also invested significantly over the last decade in China's economy, with those investments reaching around $12 billion and the reciprocal investment from China into the UAE amounting to almost $8 billion.
So what does that mean for businesses? Okay, we know that the bulge bracket tier one companies are here. Huawei's big. You can buy a phone. They're putting 5G infrastructure into the country and so on. But what about the second tier, third tier, the SMEs from China as well? Well, that's why we turn to Rainer Hu, who's the founder of a company called the China Hub UAE. And they help medium-sized Chinese companies that you haven't heard of, not household names, to do business here in the UAE and to use it as a springboard into the rest of the region. A lot of the work that she does is in electric vehicles and green energy. To put it simply, we asked her quite simply, why did you set this company up just last year? What are the opportunities that you saw?
So last year I came to Dubai and then I also went back to China. I feel there are a lot of things that we can connect together. So thanks COVID, a lot of people left China. A lot of foreign companies left China. But then China has secretly developed a lot of technology in certain sectors, especially like new energy sector, which is also my passion. For example, electric car charging stations, and also the solar panel stations. So something like that, I feel UAE should completely take advantage of it. And the second thing is that UAE is the eye of the whole world. So people come to UAE not just come to enjoy the tourism part of it. People come here to import and export stuff. So a lot of opportunities that people can see from the UAE. I think set up a foundation here is very fundamental for a lot of business who wants to establish overseas.
Raina Yu, the founder of the China Hub UAE.
Right, we've also had a bit of a focus this morning on the restaurant sector.
At the cafe down on the corner, where they lost the heart.
And indeed, we have spoken to, well, we've spoken to what was originally the cafe on Beach Road. The Lime Tree's been going for nearly quarter of a decade. So as we've
century.
Been looking, oh, thank you, quarter of a century. Yes, 23 years to be exact is the milestone that they celebrated last weekend. We've been looking at the restaurant industry from a number of angles over the last couple of days. Increasing rents, which are growing at double digit for Q1, about 10% Dubai, 15% in Abu Dhabi year on year, according to CBRE. We've been looking at the influencer business when it comes to filling new restaurants, that interview on the podcast. But we asked Corin how you keep going. Basically, how you keep relevant when you are one of the incumbents and you have a lot of competition. We began by talking about when she started up, wanting to know what the hardest thing was about getting started back in the early 2000s, including what was she paying for rent 23 years ago?
I think because our first cafe was in Jumeirah in a villa, that was very different to anything that there was in Dubai then. So trying to get through the formalities and work with the government departments was interesting and challenging. But, you know, they were receptive and here we are. And we still have that location now, 23 years later in Jumeirah.
Do you remember what you were paying for your very first rent when you set up?
Yes, I do.
And?
I think it was about $2,250 in that location.
You've got a number of locations. Give us just a ballpark figure of how much rent for a restaurant has changed.
Oh, hugely, obviously, as Dubai's growing. It can be anywhere from, you know, $800,000 to $1.5 million, depending on the location.
Right.
You gotta sell a lot of carrot cake to pay $1.5 million dirhams a year in rent.
You do indeed. We're going to hear more from Corin about how you remain a survivor in the fiercely competitive F&B industry here in Dubai, the competitive nature of which was named number 9 in the Time Out list just this morning of food places in the world. Happy to say that Naples is number 1, says the person with the ticket.
Smart. Well, you're the one of us who's eaten at El Bui.
I am.
The 3-star Michelin restaurant in Spain. Maybe Tom has as well. Tom, you must have had your fair share of... have you done many 3-star Michelin restaurants in your time?
No, not many. Certainly haven't done El Bulli and those. No. Just give me a roadside eatery any day of the week.
Which is apparently why Naples has made number 1 for its €1 grab a slice and walk pizza. But we've come in at number 9, more on the restaurant industry in the show this morning.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
We're looking in detail at that state visit to China.
Yeah, that is currently one of the most played songs on Apple Music in China at the moment, according to our producer, Isa Havilio. It will be the soundtrack for His Highness President Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed's visit to China. He's the president of the UAE and he is there as we speak. Let's get some perspective on this now from a business person who knows China and the UAE intimately. He is Patrick Tsang. He's the chairman of the Tsangs Group. It's a family office based in Hong Kong, but since COVID with a significant presence here in the UAE as well. Patrick, morning. Good to speak to you.
Morning, Richard.
How significant is this visit from your perspective?
I think it's an amazing trip. I think the last time when Sheikh Mohammed went to China and saw President Xi was during the Winter Olympics 2022 in Beijing. I think there's a few significant events happening as we speak. This is the second decade of the Belt Road Initiative, which is the big project from President Xi. It's the Comprehensive Strategic Partnership Framework, which is being designed and signed. It's also, from the UAE's perspective, it's the 40th anniversary of diplomatic ties between China and the UAE, which is a big deal, obviously. And then also China is obviously the UAE's biggest trading partner. Bilateral trade has reached around $95 billion in 23, and mainly energy, technology and media.
So as you say, I mean, the relations are already incredibly deep and incredibly strong. 18% of all UAE imports come from China. That's a staggering number from one country, even a big country like China. So where do they go from here? Because they're already ticking most of the boxes that you'd expect leaders to tick when it comes to economic relations between two countries. What's the next frontier?
I think this is even bigger than the two countries. I think it's not just Sheikh Mohammed being there. There's also leaders from other countries like Egypt. It's also the 10th ministerial anniversary of the China Arabs Cooperation Forum. So it's not just the UAE, but it's the region itself. It's actually the MENA region. But obviously, the UAE is one of the more influential partners on this trip itself. I think the bilateral trade is going to continue. For example, between 2012 and 2022, the FDI from China to the UAE actually amounted to over $11.8 billion, and China is reaching like $6.3 billion in terms of the FDI into the UAE. And big companies from China, for example, Huawei, Tencent, the big banks from China, and also China Construction have all been expanding in the UAE specifically. And this is going to continue in the next 5-10 years, from my opinion. And also companies like from tech, including like drone companies that I know, Ehang, which are the flying taxis, they're planning to launch in Dubai and the UAE in 2026.
Well, tell us about what's happening. Yeah, those tier one deals are great with the Huawei's and government to government. But a little bit below the surface, perhaps companies that aren't household names that are like Huawei, what's happening there? And give us an example, for example, of the Sangs Group, family office based in Hong Kong. You've got a big office here in Dubai now doing deals. And I know you were doing deals around COP28 in what I would loosely call the green energy space.
Correct. So we're also planning to expand in the UAE specifically, where we have a partnership with Abu Dhabi and ADGM with a regulated business, which is part of the family office. Obviously, the UAE is burgeoning, property prices, financial services, everything increasing, and we're looking to be part of that growth. From a China perspective, what I see is obviously, like you mentioned, all the state-owned companies and the big boys are all already there for some time. We're starting to see, you know, Chinese communities in the UAE, specifically Dubai, growing more. But as you know, most of the Chinese community, they tend to stick to themselves. And I think there's a gap between the big state-owned companies and this kind of like smaller SME companies. There's a group here which I think is still quite small, more, you know, professional and financial savvy investors like myself and our family offices. I think that market will still be is still quite a small sector in the UAE, I think, and this will grow in the next 5-10 years. And I think hopefully we will be one of the ones that lead that growth charge.
I mean, it's an interesting point you make about those SMEs, in Chinese SMEs or Chinese entrepreneurs or business people in Dubai. I've got to tell you, Patrick, we kind of struggled here on the Business Breakfast. We were keen to get as many Chinese business people as possible onto the show this morning to talk about their experiences. And it was difficult. I mean, maybe there's a language barrier. Maybe it's just that the Chinese business community isn't telling its story as loudly as it might be. How can we fix that, would you say? Because people want to hear the China story, but we as journalists have struggled. And that's a failing on our part, I'm sure.
I don't think it's a failing on your part. I think it's just a lack of engagement and dialogue. As you know, we created the Hong Kong Ambassadors Club last year, which was effectively a bridge from Hong Kong to the rest of the world, specifically the GCC, where we try to connect business and investors to each other and create bilateral trade and investments between all parts of the world. One thing to note about the Chinese is that culturally, obviously language is a barrier, but it can't be that big a barrier, because a lot of Chinese send their kids to international schools. They send them to the US, the UK for good education. All the kids speak English. But I think more importantly, it's more of a cultural thing. I think Chinese tend to stick within their ecosystem. I think, for example, I mentioned before in the UAE, for example, a lot of them live in international city or other parts of UAE, which some of us in UAE might not deem to be the most affluent, but they enjoy what they do because they end up just hanging out with the same people, the same culture, the same music, the same TV. And it takes a lot to be able to bridge this. It's not just a language barrier, I believe it's a cultural barrier. But in anything, I personally believe that, and especially Dubai and UAE demonstrate this greatly, is, you know, at the end of the day, we're all global citizens. Especially in Dubai, you have people from England, from Hong Kong, from Russia, from the Middle East, from Lebanon, from Egypt to South America, all together. And there are no issues of racism or any kinds of barriers, but it's all done because we all accept who we are as human beings, and we use English as the main language usually, and people just get on with it and get well and live well together. And I think we need to do more as the Chinese community to try to integrate and assimilate with the rest of the UAE residents.
We would echo those sentiments, Patrick. Thanks very much indeed for joining us this morning, live from Hong Kong. That's the voice of Patrick Tsang. He's an investor. He's the chairman of the Tsangs Group, live from Hong Kong. But as he mentioned, big investments here in the UAE as well. Speaking to us on the day that Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed, the UAE president, begins a two-day state visit in China. Those meetings are happening as we speak in China.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
Talking real estate this morning, John Lyons, Managing Director, S-Pass Real Estate in the studio. Morning, John.
Good morning.
We're talking about the influence of Chinese buyers in Dubai, or rather the lack of them at the moment. And to get us in, this is in honour of Sheikh Mohammed's visit to China at the moment. To get us in the mood, Brandy Scott is DJ this morning. But is that a sound that's going to be blaring from balconies in the marina as Chinese buyers snap up apartments? John, you say the evidence suggests no.
Yes, we've not seen the return of the Chinese buyer in the way that we thought we might see when we talked about this at the beginning of last year. And I think that is something that would be a shared sentiment with other people in the industry like myself, expecting a wave of Chinese demand coming back to the market. I don't think it's the case that there are no Chinese buyers in Dubai, obviously. We've still sold many great properties to Chinese buyers this year, but they're down in 18th place on our list of nationalities that we sell to. And I know from speaking to other industry experts that the Chinese buyers are not where they would have thought they might have been if they had considered this a couple of years ago.
Yeah, because we all thought once the flights resumed, once the COVID lockdowns ended, that would be it. Because 2019, the rise in Chinese tourists coming here, and not just on holiday, but doing business, was maybe not quite meteoric, but it was certain, the appetite was there, wasn't it? Is it just a delayed reaction? What about forward-looking indicators, if indeed there are any?
Yes, it's difficult to get a hold of the data from a market-wide level to try and figure out exactly what's going on. But it certainly does feel like 2019 has not returned. I remember the sentiment in that year where everyone was expecting there to be a significant growth in the Chinese demand in Dubai. And while there is still Chinese demand in Dubai, it just hasn't returned post-COVID the way we thought. But maybe no surprise given some of the economic challenges that China has faced over recent years. That's probably part of the story there.
Because their own off-plan real estate market is a basket case, isn't it, in many ways? And the government just 10 days ago, 2 weeks ago, had yet another, call it a bailout, call it support, call it what you will. So they have been burned.
Yeah, so they're facing their own challenges, obviously. And it's also not easy to get money out of the country. So if people do manage to sell properties in, I don't know, Beijing or Shanghai, getting the money out of the country and moving it to Dubai isn't the easiest thing for the Chinese market. So that could be part of the reason. But ultimately, I think that long term, the trade relations are clearly going to be very strong between China and the UAE. And businesses are going to continue to expand here, Chinese businesses. And I think that we will see longer term growth of the Chinese market in Dubai. But it's just not so noticeable today.
Because I would have thought economics is demographics. It would have to happen. The stats we've been reading today, others have as well, is that China is the number one source of imports into the UAE. 18% basically 20% of all imports into the UAE are Chinese. That's clearly generating a lot of money. A lot of Chinese people doing business here and making good money here. For them to be the number one source of imports, but only 18th on the list of real estate buyers, that seems like a disconnect to me.
Yes, we need to see more businesses set up here, Chinese businesses and jobs created for the Chinese market. And then I think we will see more activity. But at the moment, you're right, it's a big market for trade, but that doesn't necessarily translate into people buying properties here. And it's not, as I said, it's not that there is no Chinese demand in Dubai. There is. There probably is more than there was a year ago, but it's just not as dramatic as what we were expecting it to be, given the wave that was that had already started pre-COVID. It just didn't continue post-COVID.
Well, we'll get on to who is buying, because many people are, in a second. But a quick word on who else isn't. You talked about that list. Chinese buyers in 18th place. Russians even lower.
Yes, Russians in 19th place for Espasnow. And if we go back just to some of our conversations of 18 months ago, Russian buyers were in our top five in at certain periods. So for Russians to drop to 19th is quite a notable story. What's also very interesting when we look at the list is that British buyers are by far our biggest buyer group this year so far for the first 5 months. But also other Western European countries are very prominently in the top 10, with Germany, France, Italy and Holland also big buyers of properties from Espace Real Estate.
I mean, I've been covering this real estate market since it kicked off 20 years ago. The Netherlands has rarely been mentioned in dispatches.
Yeah, the Netherlands is right up there. It's maybe, I think, in sixth place for us this year so far. But also, when I look past our own data and I speak to friends in the industry, I was speaking to the DevMark Group recently, who are responsible. They're the development consultancy that have launched and run the sales and marketing for the Kempinski project in Dubai Marina, which has been a hugely successful project in the 6 days of this week alone, or in the last 6 days since it's launched. They've sold over $1 billion worth of real estate. And I was asking them, who's buying that real estate? And they said, it's Europeans. It's the European market, both Eastern Europe and Western Europe. Western Europe is a big buyer of that product in Dubai Marina, which is a quality project. So it just shows you that European buyers, that market is really looking for top quality product. And when something like a branded residence like Kempinski comes to a location like Dubai Marina, the European market will snap it up very quickly.
It's interesting. We had Amar Malik in earlier on, about 2 hours ago, sitting in the chair where you are now from Lombard Odier. They've done some research on wealthy expats here, and they said the same thing. It's those Europeans that we didn't have before. We've always had, he said, a lot of wealthy, obviously Gulf Arabs, expat Arabs, and wealthy Indian Pakistani people, maybe a few Brits as well, but never Europeans. But they're seeing that as well in private banking. And yeah, if they move here with their private bank account, they are going to buy bricks and mortar.
Yes, and we're noticing that Italians are a big buyer group now for us. Germans are right up there. France is in third place. So for us, the top three is the UK, then India, then France. And as we mentioned, Holland as well. So it's definitely the case that Dubai feels like it has much more demand from these Western European countries. And they very clearly want quality. They're willing to pay for quality. But if the market supplies quality, like the Kempinski, for example, in Dubai Marina, that Western European market will snap it up.
Even at a high price. What's that going for per square foot?
So it's I would say that one of the reasons why that's been a good selling project as well is that it is well-priced. It's not sort of overpriced, but it will depend. It could go from a couple of thousand dirhams per square foot up to 3,000 dirhams per square foot. I think it even might start slightly lower than that, maybe 1850, 1900 per square foot. I'm not a sales rep for that project, and full disclosure, I have no benefit for that project to be selling. It's just an interesting story for me in the real estate market to see a project like that in an off-plan market that everyone is suggesting is slightly slower this year compared to last year, which is true. The data says that. But when a product like that hits the market, over $1 billion worth of real estate, which must be the majority of the building, sells out in 6 days.
John, always good to talk to you. Appreciate your time this morning. Thanks very much indeed for coming in. The thoughts there of John Lyons. He is the Managing Director of Espace Real Estate.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast.
We also are talking the business of food this morning, speaking to restaurateurs, speaking to people who fill restaurants with beautiful people, and we're kicking off by finding out what it actually takes to make it in the restaurant industry. We are speaking to one beloved cafe brand that has survived here in the UAE for nearly a quarter of a century. Not to be sneezed at, the Lime Tree, 23 years, nearly quarter of a century. One of the first independent cafes to set up in Dubai. Corin Bowker is the co-founder. Corin, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
We've basically got you into bask in your reflected glory, popping up some posts about your anniversary. Got the most engagement that we've had on anything. Forget interest rates, forget inflation. What people care about is carrot cake.
Oh, wow. That's incredible.
Tell us why you set up 23 years ago. What did you think we needed?
I think we probably, my sister and I, started just out of looking for sort of comfort food and something that we were like used to from New Zealand, where we're originally from. Yeah, just we loved food really and ate a lot, obviously.
What was the hardest thing about getting started back then?
I think because our first cafe was in Jumeirah in a villa, that was very different to anything that there was in Dubai then. So trying to get through the formalities and work with the government departments was interesting and challenging. But, you know, they were receptive and here we are. And we still have that location now, 23 years later in Jumeirah.
Do you remember what you were paying for your very first rent when you set up?
Yes, I do.
And?
I think it was about $2,250 in that location.
You've got a number of locations. Give us just a ballpark figure of how much rent for a restaurant has changed.
Oh, hugely, obviously, as Dubai's grown. It can be anywhere from, you know, $800,000 to $1.5 million, depending on the location.
What else has changed since you first set up? How are you navigating a different landscape nearly a quarter of a century later?
I think for us, adapting to things like delivery and delivery platforms, which we never thought we would have to, because it was all about everyone coming in, meeting friends, hanging out, drinking coffee, eating cake and stuff like that. So adapting to that, and obviously as the city's growing, going with that into the communities, because obviously we are a community brand. So expanding into communities, which was never sort of part of the plan. We just were opened and we thought, well, we'll just go with it. So yeah, that as well.
How does the increased traffic and the increased time to get from A to B affect you in that regard? How do you make the decisions about where to set up?
Yes, that's really, really key. I think location is everything. For us, we are sort of looking at like the communities and I think everyone's staying within their areas a bit more now than what we used to. You know, I say in the olden days, that sounds terrible. But, you know, people would drive, you know, to Jumeirah and drive. But now we don't need to. Like Dubai's grown so much and everything's there. So you've got to be sort of quite local so that it's easy for people to get in. Access, parking, I think, is a big thing.
You've gone through a couple of challenges. You opened a major location in Motor City and then 5 minutes later COVID hit.
Yeah, that was weird. I think, yeah, at the time I was like, what are we doing building a store when everybody else is kind of, you know, reducing or kind of, you know, and I thought, what have we done? But we just had to kind of go with it. We were already like, you know, into it. So we kept building and we sort of opened, I think, sort of yeah, towards the end of COVID, and yeah, the whole thing is actually kind of a bit of a blur, but yeah, and now it's a great location. We love it there.
What did you do to make sure that you would survive COVID, that you'd come out the other side?
I think reflecting back, we had to really look internally at everything. It really made us stop on our tracks, as it would for everyone in our industry, survive, because hospitality was the hardest hit. So really think about ideas of what we could do when we could only operate at 30% or you could only use half your tables. And for us, looking internally at our processes and, you know, our people, thankfully, you know, we've still got a lot of our team. We've still got some of our team from day one, you know, and they're amazing. They add, you know, amazing strength to the brand. You know, we've got some of our guys from been with us for 23 years and in our bakery 15 years. So looking internally, improving our processes, and then obviously going on to delivery platforms, which was new for us. We weren't on any platforms like Deliveroo, Talabat, things like that. So we had to fast track all of that. So it was completely different challenges for everyone. Like everything was upside down.
And then we come out of COVID and the world's hit by a massive food inflation spike. What has that meant for you when it's come to the ingredients that you source?
Less profit, because we really want to, and we always have since day one, focus on the quality and the ingredients we still use, you know, Anchor cream cheese and things like that. So we've stuck with our ingredients. Yes, we have had to adjust pricing, which we've always tried to stay away from, but I think that's inevitable now. Like, you've got no choice. And just making sure with our menus and everything that we're adapting to what is here. Things now are a lot more plant-based and vegetarian. Like, when we opened, we might have had one vegetarian salad on the menu. Now it's completely the other way around. You might have one chicken or beef, and now it's a lot more plant-based, vegetarian, and adapting to people's allergies, dietary needs, things like that. Now, I think everyone's a lot more aware of what they're eating.
So what's the biggest challenge for you today?
Apart from my age, my tiredness. biggest challenge? Yeah, I think just keeping on top of it all and never we don't sort of tend to just sit back and relax. Like, I think in our industry, it's evolving, it's growing with the speed of the city. And I think you've got to keep with that and keep learning for yourself and for the business and globally and what's happening with food and what's available.
Because that's the big thing, isn't it? When you opened, it was basically you guys, Japango Dome, and I think at some stage more.
Yeah.
And that was it. How do you stay relevant now that there's a new sort of coffee lifestyle concept on El Wasl every 5 minutes?
I think we've evolved, but we've stayed the same. You know, it's about consistency and sticking true to our values and what we, you know, believe and or what we would like to, you know, operate within. And it's like looking at our sustainability, what we're doing with that. But yeah, I think just staying true to the food. Like, we don't go off and try and be something we're not, you know, and start introducing other sort of types of dishes onto the menu. I think we've stuck with favourite, comfort, simple food.
We've got about 30 seconds left with you. We tend to fetishise growth in business, just thinking sort of, you know, bigger, bigger, bigger. Is it the answer? Is it to just continually keep expanding and opening new outlets? Or is there a case for just enjoying what you're doing?
Yeah, for me, it's about enjoying what you're doing. You know, expanding, definitely my waist, unfortunately. But as far as locations, for me, it's about limiting that to manage consistency and quality. Because I feel that once we, you know, the risk gets bigger, the more you expand.
Karen Balka, co-founder of The Lime Tree, making it to almost quarter of a century in the F&B market here in Dubai. Dubai's just been named number 9 on the Time Out list of the 20 best places to eat in the world. We are finding out this morning what makes our restaurant sector tick. A little bit later on, we're going to be speaking to a man who helps new restaurants fill them with beautiful people. There's an app for that, apparently.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
We've got a special focus this morning on surviving in the restaurant industry. Dubai's come in number 9 this morning of the Time Out lists of 20 best places for food in the world. We've been looking at what makes or breaks a restaurant. And we are going to speak now. We're joined from London by the man who will help you fill your new restaurant with stylish, trendy people. Beautiful people, top designer clothes, front row of fashion shows. What you do and what you know inside the world. Romain Farrell is the CEO and founder of The Secret Society Dubai. He got up early for us in London this morning. Morning, Romain.
Good morning, guys. How are you?
I am well. Tell me what The Secret Society was set up to do. What type of need were you looking to fill?
So thank you for having me on the show. We started Secret Society 6 years ago in Dubai. The objective of Secret Society was to help restaurants fill up their seats mainly. We wanted to help them cater to the right individuals, the right bloggers, the right models, we believe that a successful restaurant is a restaurant that have the right population in. So Secret Society position ourselves as an app that help you cater to this population.
Okay, so let's look at how it works. From the, and we'll just call them influencers generally, point of view,
yeah.
What happens?
So basically when you are an influencer, you can register on the platform. It's a private platform, so it's not a platform for everyone. You apply for it, you link your social media to us. We are one of the only app in the world that work directly with Meta. So you can link your social media to us. We get a full report about your follow. And if obviously the report is positive, you will be accepted on the app. When you are accepted on the app, you have access to a portfolio of activations. And all of these activations are very transparent. You can on one side see what you can do. So you can see a free day bed in a beach club, a VIP table in a nightclub, a dinner in one of your favorite restaurants. And in exchange of that, the payment method is a list of marketing deliverables. So you will need to take a certain amount of stories, leave positive reviews on TripAdvisor, stay in the venue for a certain amount of time. The list of deliverables goes on.
Okay, and from the restaurant or the nightclub or the beach club side, how does it work?
On the side of the restaurant, the bloggers apply for an offer, and the restaurants can see all the people that have applied, and they can select. So they can, it's a swiping system where they can swipe on one side saying like, I do like this person, or they can swipe right saying, I do not want to collaborate with this person. Therefore, they can cater and choose with which person they will collaborate. The good thing with what we do is the fact that each of our members are rated. The rating is visible to the members itself, very similarly to Uber. So the managers can see the ratings that other venues have been giving to them.
What do they get that rating and on, Romain?
Their rating on the ability of like fulfilling deliverables, because you know you can be a great blogger, but if you do not take the right amount of stories, you will get a lower rating. And they will be a judge on their ability to respect guidelines. So come on time to the activation, which is a problem in Dubai, but it's a problem all over the world, I will say. And as well, their ability of like, you know, being nice to the venue. So being respectful to the staff of the venue.
And how do you get paid?
We get paid by the venues in order to be listed on a mobile application. It's a monthly retainer that our clients are paying. They pay us a monthly retainer and they can get as many people as they want in their venues.
What kind of money are we talking for that monthly retainer?
It's roughly around 800 US dollars, so 3,000 dirhams, basically per month. So it's pretty affordable. We say that our solution is ROI insured. We make sure that basically with the 3,000 dirhams that you pay, that you get the right amount of people. And you can, through us, you can basically replace modeling agencies. You can replace PR agencies. And you can replace promoters that bring you girls. So if you look on a spectrum of things, a lot of promoters are getting paid per ads that they bring to the venues. It can be up to like 100 dirhams per person. With us, basically, we have hotels, we have restaurants that are working with, I would say, like 1,000 to 2,000 person on a monthly basis. So that's why we say that Secret Society is ROI insured.
Okay, so you've said the right people a couple of times. I'm looking at your website and you sort of say not everyone's going to get accepted. Your profile has to match our standards. What counts as the right people for you?
It's a good question. We say that we're looking for lifestyle individuals. So what I'm going to be looking at is people that can influence other people. Lifestyle individuals are people that are obviously people that loves going out, people that are followed, not necessarily only on social media. So that's why we don't speak exclusively about bloggers. We are speaking about people that can move other people, a photographer, a clothing brand designer. It can be people that are working in the modeling world. We have a lot of like real estate agents on the app. We have a lot of cabin crews. I think at the minute we have like something close to 7,000 cabin crews on the app.
But to play devil's advocate, this might help a venue to look busy while they're effectively paying for people to have free nights out and free meals. But it's not real love for a venue, and we're all getting quite digital savvy. I mean, most people can look and tell when something's genuine or not, and indeed there are rules here in Dubai about having to flag up, as there are in most jurisdictions in the world, if something is paid for or free. So is there a genuine benefit long term for these businesses of paying people to come for an evening?
So it's a good question. If you look at it in a sense where we just bring people to sit in the restaurants, there is some benefit, some collateral benefits to that only. You know, there is nothing worse than an empty restaurant for multiple reasons. Obviously, you launch a new branch in Dubai, you launch a new menu, a new night that you were not open before. Having an empty restaurant ensures you of you not making money. So there's been someone that will come, a group of individuals will come and will never come back because they will be, it was, the food was great, but the place was absolutely dead. It's as well very, very bad for your own staff to operate an empty restaurant. So that's the two big problems of not having anyone coming to your place. But now we are not just sending people just to fill up the restaurants.
Okay.
These people need to take a certain amount of stories and they need to leave positive reviews on TripAdvisor.
Unfortunately, we do have to leave it there this morning, out of time for Roman Farrell. He's the CEO and founder of the Secret Society Dubai, waking up early to join us from London. Thank you very much for your time.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.